risk preparedness is something which is not just the pharmaceutical, but is a broad industry as well as government. And it's one of the unique places where we as an industry, we have to work with governments and NGOs and all of the different constituents to make things work. It has to go fast, it has to be organized, it has to be effective, because pandemics arise whenever they want to arise somewhere in the world. And since we are working on this, and when it came really to the global scale with the West Africa epidemic 4 years ago, the community here and all of you who were part of it came in a very effective way together. At that moment, the industry collaboration to get going on what are the logistics, how do we need to bring the right materials with all of the different companies into the regions, specific on airlines, on telephone companies, data companies, all of that were mobilized in order to combat the epidemic. Massive number of governments had to send people to the region, building hospitals and taking care, ultimately to many measures, including the use of the Merck vaccine in the region, there was the possibility with it was under control. But before we knew, it got into another area in Congo on the west side and now on the east side. And now we are in a situation that we really don't know what to do because it's in a war zone. And so now it's a very big risk. The epidemic is 250 kilometers long. It's now on the border of Sudan and Rwanda and Uganda. And the risk of the new epidemic could be massive again for the world. And so if not handled well and not controlled well, we could be again where we were before. CEPI was found in the meantime, which was a huge commitment from different governments. It was hard work for 1 year. He had to work. We started 1 year later, we launched. So Richard is here. Somewhere down there. Hi, Richard. Richard is the CEO in the meantime, and he's working hard with different industries, academic centers, to place the 10 or more the viruses now, which are on that list of pandemic potential, into research status and getting going on vaccines. Conclusion for that, today the science is there to do the diagnostics, make the vaccines, and eventually also make drugs. We have to make sure that we are aligned between the regulators, the countries, and the whole industry on how we can bring those effective tools. That's one way, prepare and treat. Diagnostic industry has to get aligned on how to get to the diagnostics in order to diagnose fast and early. And the rest of industry, everyone who provides supplies to pandemics for treating and handling, we have to get organized in order to make sure we are agile and fast and acting, and that's why the time is here. Acting against the risk, business we cannot ignore. Let's get going and have a good discussion this morning. Thank you for all being here, and hopefully a very productive outcome. We'll continue our work and make sure that we can prevent vaccines. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Paul. I love picking up on the theme of we need fast, organized, and effective. So thank you for setting the tone for us this morning and for hosting. And next, I would like to introduce Peter Sands, Executive Director of the Global Fund, for our keynote remarks on engaging business in this endeavor. Welcome.
Thank you so much, and good morning, everybody. At the risk of being rude to my hosts, I'm going to suggest that at this meeting we have both the wrong title and the wrong audience, because acting against a risk that business cannot ignore is an ambitious title when most businesses do ignore the risk, and most businesses are taking no action. And the reason I think we've got the wrong audience is the exception to the rule is the people who have bothered to get up this early in the morning to come and talk about epidemic risk. But we face a collective challenge because that is the reality, is that most businesses don't think, most business leaders I know don't think about this at all. And that is a problem. It's a problem for those businesses, but it is a problem for the broader society and economy because it makes the broader society and economy more vulnerable to these risks. It's with that in mind that together with WEF, I, wearing my Harvard hat, with some colleagues, with some WEF colleagues, and with working with J&J, Edelman, UPS, and DHL, we came up with this report, which we published on Friday, Outbreak Readiness and Business Impact, or ORBIT. And actually, there's a software visualization tool that goes up along with it. And the basic thesis there is that we need businesses to manage epidemic risk in the same way that sophisticated businesses manage other kinds of risks, which, with very few exceptions, they are not doing at the moment. And this is a problem because infectious disease outbreaks appear for one reason or another. Other people like Paul will know more about this than I, to be on the increase. This threat is not going away. If anything, it is increasing. And secondly, while with all the advances of medical science, we are getting better at containing the mortality and morbidity impacts of these outbreaks, if anything, the world is becoming more vulnerable to the economic side of it, because most of the economic risk is actually a function of fear. And in a hyper-connected world, fear travels far faster than any virus. And you saw that with Ebola, with economic impacts in places which were, you know, thousands of miles away from the 1415 outbreak. You see it with all sorts of, with MERS, where the economic impact on Korea was hugely, in a sense, out of proportion to the actual scale of the outbreak. And this is not some sort of theoretical economic impact. It is economic impact because it impacts businesses. It stops customers going into shops and cinemas. It disrupts supply chain. It means that employees can't get to work. I ran Standard Chartered for 9 years. For some reason, I ended up running a business which happened to be deeply affected by a number of these things. Our largest business was in Hong Kong, and we went through SARS. We're the largest foreign investor in Korea. We had MERS. We were the only international bank operating in the bit of West Africa where you had the 1415 Ebola outbreak. And we learned a lot of really, really practical things. It's very difficult when most of your employees are young women in branches to run an organization when the schools close because these young women cannot go to work. It's very difficult to run an organization when people are scared to get on buses and can't commute. And it is vitally important to any economy that ATMs are filled with cash. Things fall apart actually relatively quickly, and in some ways our more sophisticated economies would fall apart faster simply because of the nature of the interconnections. So the thesis is that businesses should both be monitoring and managing these risks in the way that they do other risk, and that there are lots of things you can do to analyze and understand the nature of the threats affecting your businesses, and there are lots of things you can do to mitigate and prepare for such threats in a systematic way. I think that is a no-brainer thing for international businesses to do, or businesses operating in areas of vulnerability. I also think it's a really important thing for broader society that businesses do it, because it will make these societies more resilient. And also, frankly, as businesses understand these risks better, they'll become more powerful advocates for governmental action on preparedness and response. That's all I was going to say. And do read this.
I want to make another plug for the report, because I did read it, and it was just as Peter sort of shatters even the title of the conference. Within the first paragraph of Peter's foreword, I had a deeply held belief completely demystified, which was the story, Peter, of the frog that's thrown into boiling water and would jump out, but it was slowly boiled over time. The frog would be in the water and dying. How many people have heard that story? And how many believe that that's how a frog would behave? Well, it turns out modern biologists say, no, that frog would jump out, even if slowly, but more likely humans would not jump out. So we're absolutely fascinating. I want to take this time to introduce my panelists and welcome them to the stage. Julie Gerberding from Merck MSD, Richard Edelman from Edelman, and Stanley Bergman from Henry Schein. And while everyone's coming to the stage, I just wanted to appreciate very much Peter's comments on how practically businesses can respond and how practically it influences their work. I've been involved recently in the cholera response in Zimbabwe, and it's been amazing to see one particular local telecom company there, Econet, is the largest telecom company, come forward in a very practical way when they mobilized thousands of volunteers to help do cleanup. They are funding the Emergency Operations Center. They've been helping to they donated $10 million. I mean, I think there's global corporations and then also local corporations, but it's just quite exciting to see. And in global health, we talk about this concept of positive deviance, where how do you look for the companies that are doing it well and right and replicate that. So excited to discuss some of those lessons learned with everyone. I'd love to begin with Julie. We've had just to see the Ebola vaccine actually get out into the field has been remarkable, and I know that took a great deal of effort and collaboration. I wonder if you could share with us some of the lessons learned from that experience and what we might be looking forward ahead.
Thank you. And I do want to just start by thanking people for being here, because this is important, as Peter tried to point out in his opening remarks. Kind of disappointed that I think I know many of the people in the room, because that means that the people who should be here aren't. So we have to do a better job of networking and bringing our friends along in this regard. The Ebola situation in the DRC, as of about 6 hours ago, there is 699 cases reported. So that's 19 more since Friday, and that means that the situation is still not under control and the outbreak is continuing to perpetuate, at least in Katwa. So I'm very glad that we have one countermeasure there in the field in the way of a vaccine, which we hope is working. It's an experimental vaccine right now because it's not licensed. But we need a lot more tools in our toolbox to really be effective and confident that we're going to be able to manage even what is, by Ebola standards now, a relatively small outbreak at this point. So we have learned a lot since 2014, when MSD and GSK and JFJ first stepped up in the context of the Western African Ebola outbreak and tried to fast track the development of vaccines that could be helpful. And I won't go into the technical aspects of that development, what we learned about antigens and antibody response, but I will say that we uncovered a whole cascade of complexity. There's a mythology that if you just have the vaccine, then everything will be fine. It's very, very complex, even to test the vaccine safety. Before we even put a single dose in the arm of anyone in Western Africa, we had to do safety studies. That meant getting rapid permits to move antigen or vaccine from the U.S. to Germany, Switzerland, Austria, where we were testing the safety. That meant involving the FDA, the whole problem of exportation and importation, setting up the IRB process, the diagnostic process, the immunoassays. It's an incredibly complex series of activities that have to be well coordinated. And each of us was more or less doing that in our own vertical, because we had different kinds of vaccines and we had different problems and different partners. So before we even knew we had something safe enough to try, we were plagued with a panoply of partners. I don't mean plague in a negative sense, but just it really was almost an outbreak of partnerships that occurred simultaneous with the outbreak of Ebola. Then when you fast forward into the situation where the experimental vaccines were being used, three vaccines, three countries, three sets of partners,
very difficult to cross-coordinate in that context. The IRB process was individualized, the protocols and designs of the trials were individualized. Everything was invented as we went forward. So I think, broadly speaking, one of the most important lessons we learned is that a lot of these steps are actually predictable, and we could have been much more prepared even for an unknown outbreak if we had things like harmonization of the IRB process, regulatory harmonization, broad agreements of study design and informed consent processes and so forth. Now fast forward to where we are today, using an unlicensed vaccine in a country that is not sophisticated in the implementation of clinical trials, in an environment that is rife with conflict and basically terrorism. This is kind of the worst case scenario, a challenge test for public health. As many of you know, the CDC is not even in the DRC because it's deemed unsafe for US government officials to be operating in the DRC side of the border. So we don't really know what's going on there. And I think that also speaks to the predictable knowns as well as the predictable unknowns of what it takes to really execute. So I'm all, you know, I'm a champion of CEPI. I worked really hard to try to support the launch of CEPI, but the really hard work of making a vaccine valuable to people in the context of an outbreak has only just begun. And we really have a heavy lift. There's a Sisyphean task, and I don't think the public health system can do it. We really do need to engage the advocacy and the support of the private sector in all of these regions to create a more sophisticated response capability. I'll just stop there.
Thank you. I'm just, as a follow-up, I'm curious, the outbreak of partners, the outbreak of epidemics is quite an interesting concept, and I wonder if something like Ebola actually brought, because it was known and had received so much attention, would have more of a partnerships coming forward than what if this was an unknown pathogen, and do we have the same level of collaboration that's happening for less media attention diseases? Maybe this is a good
I think, you know, the situation in West Africa was extreme. It was frightening. It was more of a SARS situation than an avian influenza situation in terms of the overall public attention and impact that it had. And it really was a demonstration of the hyper-geomobility of our society, because that outbreak in Western Africa was really, in part, the mobility of people from rural to urban areas, the mobility of the urban diaspora and the juxtaposition with animals and sources of these viruses, but also the hypermobility of people moving there to be helpful, businesses and travelers moving from there back to the U.S., family members emigrating to try to receive care, just really the vast connectivity of the world in which we operate. And in that kind of a highly connected environment, the stakeholder map is enormous. So it's natural that there would be many, many stakeholders and partners who would get involved in a situation like that. We welcome partnerships, but I do think that we need, in the same way we talk about regulatory harmonization to try to accelerate the development of vaccines, we need to talk about partner harmonization so that we can leverage the power of the partnerships and do a little bit better job planning in advance.
Thank you. Richard, I'd love to turn to you. Your incredible annual trust barometer has come out, and I think it has real implications and lessons learned for epidemic preparedness. Can you tell us something about that?
So there's a important change in the landscape of trust. As you all know, over the last 15 or 20 years, there's been dispersion of authority. So that which was pioneered by Moses, the top-down from authority kind of way, doesn't work anymore. It moved to a peer-to-peer, horizontal kind of process. In the last 2 years, that has been undermined by fake news. And so the new norm for trust is local. It comes to my employer, most trusted institution in the world, by a long way now, is my employer. Because I can see my employer somehow. I feel in a full employment economy. I can influence the employer's behavior. And if I don't like it, I can leave. And the employer has to have values and mission and all these things, but most important, the employer has a channel. Let me just describe the communications landscape at the moment. Trust in search and in mainstream is quite high, the highest we've seen in years, almost ever. Trust in social is destroyed, especially in developed markets, but now increasingly in developing markets. So the so-called horizontal channel, the thing that everybody said, oh, you know, Google and Facebook are on our side and we've got it solved, not so, not so. And also, the mainstream media model, even if media trust is going up, the model is broken. So the number of journalists is reduced by half in the last 10 years. And the journalists covering health is reduced by more than half because it's not a easily monetizable advertising vehicle. So again, you know this about the quality of people covering healthcare, it is diminished. So what I'm suggesting today, maybe a little heretical, but what the hell, Stavros, I think you have to go direct to the end user of information and the primary channel has to become my employer. And again, that means that companies need to stop being advocates and start being educators. It means that the channel needs to be run between public affairs and PR on one side and science on the other. It has to be a joint team, and that people who work for a company, big or small, need to feel as if it is quality and objective information. It needs to be third-party sourced, and it needs to not simply be CEO scare tactics, it needs to be a technical expert who has some, you know, MD behind him or her and says, you know, this is what you should do as an employee. And then please, here's something shareable for your community that you can pass around that's quality information. The battle for truth is a fundamental problem in the world. We know this from the country that I'm in, where fake news is the norm. But the issue that we're dealing with here is one of falsehood is shared 10 times more often than fact. Fake news is shared much more often than fact. And so we've got to improve the quality of the communication stream. And that's why I'm advocating for employer to step up, not simply, Peter, in the way of preparedness and one of the keys to preparedness, I'm arguing, is the communications channel. And that when you do your sort of scenario planning, that you put communications as a first priority in what you do, so that people understand that the direct channel is deeply credible, will be updated consistently, and will have voices, not just of the top down, but of the people actually in the experience so that they can be responded to.
That's good. I feel like all of us come to Davos each year to deeply listen, to hear something new, to take a pulse on the state of the world, and hopefully change how we were going to plan our 2019. And so can you give us, I think that you laid this out well, but I would love to hear, for those of us that might be CEOs of our organization, or you could go back and now talk to the comms department differently, what do we do differently on January 28th? What are those first tangible action steps that we can take to implement your recommendations?
I think first, a go-direct operation needs a sort of different sort of quality of people. It needs more visual and shareable and short form. It needs also a more arguably science and promotion kind of personnel. And it requires also some connectivity in market with sort of local thought leaders, because influencers in social matter tremendously. And they are amplifiers. And so the classic, you know, I pitch the media and that's done. No. Those influencers, those 30 people who are the amplifier sharers, are the critical success factors. We learned this in Samsung when they had a certain problem with their phones. They can't mention the word. those 30 influencers were the keys to.
Great, thank you so much. Stan, go ahead.
I want to add one thing. You know, corporations are required, publicly traded companies are required to do risk assessment and report it annually. And it's amazing to me how few companies include pandemic preparedness or infectious disease outbreak in their risk matrix. It's just really not reaching the level of C-suite attention. And so, you know, it's understandable to me why our communication strategies wouldn't be ready, because we don't really see it as a threat that measures up against the other things we put on our risk group.
And if I'm the, you know, comms person, HR and operations are the two key partners in this, you know, and I would be deeply connected. PR is oftentimes a vertical silo. Bad idea. It has to have a mandate at this kind of time to be across.
I love your point, Julie, though, about including it on the risk register. But I thought risk registers get reviewed by the senior leadership team and quarterly by the board, and I think that getting it to that level of attention, as well as harmonizing across the organization, is so important. Well, I wanted to turn to Stan. It's been said that epidemic response is a lot about logistics. Why is this the case, and what role public-private partnership plan?
So, Ed, thank you for convening us, Paul. By the way, Julie, I think you're 100% correct. We worry about what's in front of us, and right now, the number one area that companies are looking at from a risk point of view is cybersecurity, which is terrible. The issues are terrible, 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 and you can't pour in more resources. You just can't pour in enough resources because it's just... But a pandemic... issues, pandemic planning, just they're there and it gets one or two lines. Glad to know, Richard, that we're more trusted in business now than you told us a few years ago. So the part I want to talk about is probably the most boring part of this whole dialogue. But if you think about it, it's quite important. It's making sure that the MedSurg products, infection control products, are at the right place at the right time, just at the time when potential pandemic is announced. So I'll give you an example of what got us motivated. There were a couple of others, because we've been talking about this topic for about 15 years actually, since I first came to Davos. During the SARS epidemic, call from some friends in Hong Kong who said that they told us that the hospital system in Hong Kong had run, the major hospitals in this public system had run out of masks. Where could we find them? Well, it was very simple. The largest mask manufacturers are actually in southern China, 50 miles, 100 miles away from Hong Kong. And literally within hours, we were able to identify a source for masks. The bottom line is, at a time when a pandemic, or there's an suspected epidemic, people are not thinking about the infection control issue. And the big issue is, if you get the cleaning solutions out, if you get the masks out in time, you can really prevent the spreading of the disease. So we've been talking, had been talking about this for a long time at Davos, and about 4 years ago, in a meeting that included the then head of the World Food Program, the then head of the World Health Organization, and the head of the then president of the World Bank, plus a couple of companies, including UPS, I'm glad to see Gary Cohn here from BD, and J&J were in the room, and a couple of other companies. And we said to the leaders of these various NGOs, you call us to a meeting and we will come. Well, the head of the World Food Program at that time, Ethan Cousins, right, called us to a meeting in New York City about a month after the Davos meeting, and BD, UPS, J&J, and us, we got a few other companies to come to this meeting, And the goal was to develop a list of key products that would be required should there be a pandemic potential, and where to find those products. So what we did was form the Pandemic Supply Chain Network, which was a group of people, volunteers, companies that got together to really talk to the World Health Organization on coming up with a list. So it took about 2 years for the World Health Organization to come up with a list of products needed. And finally, in September, the World Health Organization came up with a list of key products that are needed to respond to a pandemic. And I see Ryan Moorhard with us, and he took this initiative on behalf of the World Economic Forum and advanced the initiative, and which has resulted in us convening this group of companies and the multilateral organizations convening on a regular basis. Now we've pretty much advanced the list. It's publicly available. We're starting to put together a decent list of where the products can be found. And we've got networks, dialogue with these large multinational organizations. So they know who to call in the private sector, and we in the private sector know who to call in the multilateral environment should there be a need. And so I think this is an example of where the public and private sector, public-private partnerships, can kick in and get things done. And of course, the supply chain is important. It's not as exciting as necessarily developing a vaccine, but at the end of the day, if you don't have these products in the right place at the right time, you have a challenge.
I think maybe that's one of our tasks. How do we make it more exciting? Because I think it's exciting. Maybe Richard can help us. I had a conversation once with Paul Farmer, who said, you know, I just can't figure out how to make health system strengthening seem as sexy as outbreak response. It's not the topic of a Hollywood blockbuster with A-list actors. So I think this is one of our communications challenges. Because I actually recently, this week, launched a book on some of the extraordinary stories from the movement to end neglected tropical diseases. And one of the chapters was a follow the pill story from first mile to last mile. And I think there's a really amazing human challenges and people stepping up in incredible ways that do care about how to make that all connect. So thank you so much. I'd love to turn, and I don't know, Richard, if you have something to say about that. How could we really shine that light
Peter,
on supply chain?
You know, there's lessons from the Red campaign, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you know, interest in HIV was going down and you know, was cured. Well, it wasn't cured. And, but, you know, people go this way or that way. If you associate it with a product purchase, something I can do for something, if you also somehow are able to personalize it, stories is a classic thing. Also challenge, you know, here's the goal, here's where we are. I mean, you've got to give somebody, if you want to run an 8-minute mile in your training, you've got to have an objective. And I think there's so many competing issues in your day. Also, again, this Go Direct channel for corporations is a really valuable means of reiterating a company's, like J&J's, commitment to, and here's an individual who's making a difference. Just use the Go Direct channel. You know, I'm not touting President Trump. It's the one thing that I agree with what he's done. He's 55 million people follow him on social every day. He's his own media. Smart companies can have 5 million followers. If you're the substantive player in a given category, whether it's supply chain or vaccine, you really can draw audience. The World Economic Forum has 5 million unique followers for its site because it's putting up content. It aggregates. So just learn from those.
Thank you. Julie, I'd love to turn to you and see if you have any other comments on just what are our roadblocks going ahead in terms of epidemic preparedness.
Well, that would be a really long meeting. I think there are a lot of roadblocks, but I would maybe turn it around and say, you know, the glass is half full because we have proof of concept that you can mobilize multilaterals, private sector partnerships, and work in some of the most difficult public health environments in the world and still accomplish a great deal of good in a relatively amazingly fast period of time. So we need to recognize the assets that we do have. We have great science now. We have CEPI. I think there are 6 Lhasa vaccine candidates that have been funded, 4 for MERS. Richard can say more about that maybe when we come to the Q&A. But, you know, we've got tools that are coming into our toolbox, and we have, you know, the interest of the people in this room, which is obviously an asset. So there are a lot of steps that we can build from. But I think the real issue is, do we have the leadership commitment and the will to expand the level of engagement beyond the choir? And it's not just a communication campaign. I think we have to help leaders understand that this is a risk that businesses can't ignore. And we don't want to wait until it's in their face to find that out. I'm very frustrated as a person who's been involved in this world since AIDS emerged in San Francisco in 1981, and then my government time was SARS and anthrax and monkeypox and West Nile and avian influenza, and every single time there's an outbreak, there's an urgency, and money comes, and people get excited, and meetings occur, and energy is aggregated. And then when the threat subsides, the media attention dwindles, eventually the resources subside, and then we're back to the state of complacency. And that has happened every single time there's a significant outbreak, there's an after action review. If you read them all sequentially, they all say the same thing. And so part of leading and preparing our enlightened self-interest is also to advocate for the sustained investment in the entities and agencies that have the responsibility for maintaining the long journey toward much better preparedness as a society. And that's something everybody can participate in, that advocacy. And it's not just, you know, in the U.S., it's the CDC and the NIH and the response agencies, and globally, we need to make sure that we have that kind of strength emerging in many more places, including our multilateral organizations.
Stan, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
Well, I actually was going to add. I was going to ask. Richard, I wasn't sure why you were on this panel, but I do now. No.
I'm your friend.
Yeah, but really, you're the friend of the world. How do we tell people in the world today, leaders, that a pandemic situation could emerge at any moment? Right now, I bet you don't find it in any newspaper. Julie, when you were at CDC, it was probably on page 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of the newspaper. Well, it was anthrax or whatever. It is a complete dead topic. It's never it's not discussed in boardrooms today. It's not discussed in government. It's public health people are dealing with other issues. Yes, there's a group of people that are focused on this, and they're talking about it, but we all know that this is a real worldwide danger.
So for me, it needs a frame around supply chain. It needs a frame around service businesses, which are vulnerable, as your bank was. I remember you had people in India or wherever it was that they couldn't go to work. I mean, you know, so you couldn't service customers. It needs I think, to the boardroom approach right now, so that it becomes a financial markets issue, a governance issue. It's not a popular issue, and the number of journalists has shrunken, as I explained. And so it's harder to get these stories around, but narrowcast, in the same way that the sustainability crowd has been very effective at continuing to push the FTSE for good and this sort of thing, it's to the directors, and make it a risk for them to not be attentive. And maybe find 3 or 4 directors who become the, you know, paradigm kind of directors and saying, oh, I got Barclays Bank to switch how they were doing it because, and here's why. And then it becomes a story for the FT.
I'm struck by your comment earlier on the power of the 30 influencers.
Yes.
Combined with Julie saying, I'm looking out into the room and I'm a little sad that I know everybody. And perhaps that, you know, we're in Davos, the hub of influencers. If we had this topic and conversation next year, maybe we should all take it on board to say, I'm going to bring one person that I know is in town who otherwise wouldn't hear this conversation.
Well, maybe it should be a main stage event instead of a tent down the street, right?
Yeah. So Ryan, we're going to work on that.
We have a new project for Ryan Mohart, right?
I'm nodding,
Julie. Well, Julie did mention we wanted to get a little bit of Q&A in. I know we don't have that much time, but we've got some incredible people in the audience. I don't know, do we have an extra mic to pass around or just ask people to be loud? Or I'm happy to share my mic and
hey,
Stan
Mark,
and I can
Mark,
change.
Take mine, we can share.
Okay. Thank you. And please just introduce yourself and pose your question.
Sure, thank you. I'm Mark Henderson. I'm from Wellcome Trust. We're very involved in a lot of epidemic preparedness work, helping set up CEPI, et cetera. I really wanted to pick up on what Richard was saying about the role of employers as a communication channel in epidemics, and really just to introduce you very briefly to an initiative that we have up and running already that aims to do that. We're working with one of Richard's colleagues, Maggie Farley, and with Ryan and Rihanna from the forum. And what we're trying to do is to set something up that will connect large employers and their internal communications channels with the reliable, accurate information that we would want them to be disseminating via those channels in an epidemic. We think there's a sort of triple win-win potentially going on here. First of all, there's the immense trust in employers that Richard's survey has shown in even greater measure this year. Secondly, you've got the fact that these employers already have channels that reach vast numbers of people, and they know how to optimize their materials for their audience. So we don't have to reinvent a communication channel in order to get out to very large numbers of people. And thirdly, we think that the more enlightened employers ought to be thinking, well, my employees are going to want this information. They're going to need it if there is something serious going on. So we're at the stage at the moment, we've got a concept note, Ryan and Rihanna and I have copies that we can give anybody afterwards. We're hoping to get to the stage where we're able just to bring together a small group of companies that are interested in this as a concept. We don't know if it will work or not. We need just a little resource to put together a kind of working party, a project manager, hold some meetings. Hopefully, a year from now, we then might be in a position to say, this is a goer, this is something we can do.
Thank you so much for that contribution. Go ahead, thank you.
Hi, my name is Jeannie Burgo, and I'm the president of Internews. I'm thrilled to hear the focus on communications in this conversation. We believe really strongly, I mean, it's very interesting to talk about the global communication strategies, but if you think about it at the local level, in Liberia, in Sierra Leone, in DRC, there's a huge communication need there to communicate with the affected communities. And we've worked with the local media in all of those places. We're in the DRC right now trying to engage the local media there to make sure that the people affected by the epidemics have the information they need and understand what's going on. We think it's almost as important as the medical response. And so I'm curious to hear from all of you, what have you seen works best when it comes to communicating with the local community, the affected populations, when it comes to pandemics?
Who'd like to take that?
Thank you for that question, because in the list of partners that I mentioned, I really need to mention the most important partners, which are the governments and the organizations of civil society in the countries that are affected. I think when we look at this from an outside view, we start with the kind of mental model that there's no there, when in fact there's enormous capacity even in this area of the DRC that's affected. In fact, the DRC has managed successfully more Ebola outbreaks than any other country. They know how to do this. It's just that in this situation, the conflict is making their resources ineffective. So in the local environment in the US, we know that when you survey people, the person they most want to hear from is not the CDC director or the Surgeon General, or certainly not the secretary or the president. People want to hear from their own doctor. So the local doctor is a really important resource in kind of the Western context. And I think the same principle applies locally in countries where we've had, for example, vaccine hesitancy in Zambia. The outside influences are not important. It's the local influencers that Richard mentioned, but particularly local influencers who are trusted by people as a resource for medical information. And you can augment that. For example, in Zambia, we couldn't launch a vaccine program until the first lady, who happened to be a gynecologist, reassured people that, yes, this HPV vaccine was safe and her family members were being vaccinated. But it really is the local, trusted, it may not be a licensed medical practitioner, but it's whoever people trust.
Thank you so much, Julie. I just did a time check and realized we're going to need to wrap up this panel. This has been incredible. Please join me in a round of applause. I think ending on country ownership is perfect. Did you want to? Okay, great. Thank you. All right. While we're transitioning, I would love to introduce Tom Inglesby. Welcome, Tom, from Johns Hopkins University. And you are going to share with us, hopefully, a ray of hope and an event that's upcoming to help contribute to this.
That's a tall order, yes. Okay, thanks so much. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you to UPS, J&J, and the World Economic Forum for this event. It's very exciting to be here, and I want to commend WEF for all of the work it's been doing to gather global business on pandemic preparedness, epidemic response. It's really, I think, a dramatic change in the world in the last 5 years, and Ryan Morhard himself has really amped it up substantially in the last few. So you've heard a great deal about the ongoing epidemic in DRC, but can you guess how many epidemics every year come to the attention of WHO some of the world's most dreaded diseases? More than 200 epidemics a year of yellow fever, cholera, plague, avian influenza, et cetera, come to the attention of WHO, some of which WHO has to get involved in, but all of which are affecting national governments and businesses around the world. So now imagine that in this coming year, with 200 epidemic events already straining resources around the world, we have an event 201, event 201. But this event is the severe pandemic that we've all been preparing for and working to avoid and to mitigate. So how would WHO and national governments respond if this occurred in 2019? What would be the impact on global business? The businesses in this room are among the most prepared in the world, but if we look beyond this room and think about global business impact from a pandemic in 2019, I think we can all imagine that they would be dramatic and substantial. And could global businesses help national governments and international NGOs, UN organizations, to dramatically diminish the impact of a pandemic? I think that's the question. That's what motivates a lot of our work in this room. So with that as the background, we are excited to announce that our center is working with WEF, partnering with WEF and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to hold a major pandemic exercise in October of 2019, which will draw together global business and the WHO and national governments to consider these issues and shine a light on them and see if we can identify paths forward. The exercise will be called Event 201 in honor of the potential of pandemic, and will involve global business leaders, officials from national governments and international organizations. And in this exercise, they will need to find ways for governments to help businesses survive and for businesses to help governments survive, all while working to end a pandemic. The exercise is going to show how pandemics demand global expertise and collaboration across the spectrum of competencies, not just public health, which is sometimes what people think about from afar, but business, science, political leadership, communications, finance, and security. That's something that Bill Gates has emphasized over and over again in his public announcements, how important it is to have security aligned with national government and public health in a pandemic event like this. Our own center, and I think many of you have seen extraordinary value in exercises in the past. We have seen leaders have experiential learning and become emissaries for change. We have showed the seams. Exercises have shown the seams in national government plans and international agreements. It's even led to the development of new vaccines and the stockpiling of vaccines and major legislation has resulted. And we saw this kind of high impact in an exercise that we did earlier this year called CLADEX, in which we involved former and current major US government leaders, including Julie Gerberding, who played members of the US National Security Council responding to a new pandemic. They did about as well as I can imagine any leaders doing in this kind of environment, but it showed how much work on the US side and on the global side we have to do to be able to respond to these events. And to get a scope of the kinds of challenges, to get a sense of the scope of the kinds of challenges and intensity of the exercise we are planning for October of 2019, we have a very short movie trailer that came out of CLADEX in the fall. It's only a minute long, but we're going to show it to you just to give you get you in the mood of what this exercise is going to be like. So if you could show that video.
We are continuing our coverage of a new and deadly infectious disease.
The virus has some genetic elements of the Nipah virus.
The care of these patients requires extraordinary effort.
We cannot and will not voluntarily take patients from other hospitals.
The creation and intentional release of the CLADEX virus.
The impact of not doing something has lots of consequences.
We can't retreat from the rest of the world.
The continuity of government here cannot be overestimated.
A federal quarantine of this scale is unprecedented.
The question everywhere, when will there be a vaccine?
We have got to engage the private sector.
They know that we don't have a vaccine yet. They want vaccines to be prioritized.
I would not want to pull those people back.
And we need on the ground to be able to assure protection of our first responders.
This is a non-starter. I'm going to need these people. I got this feeling in a whole lot of other places.
More than 40 countries are reporting outbreaks, and many more are suspected of having cases.
Leadership requires doing things that are oftentimes unpopular.
This issue has the amazing capacity to be number 11 on anybody's list of 10 most important items.
We have been unbelievably weakened by this crisis.
What the world will look like when it's done is still very uncertain.
Okay, and it's that final comment which is really going to drive our thinking and planning around Event 201 in the fall. What will the world look like in a pandemic on the scale of this, or one that we have all been preparing for? Within the preparedness community, there's often a lament that people say, well, we won't really get prepared until we have a pandemic upon us. I think the efforts in this room today and all the work that's going on in companies show that that's not true. And I think exercises like the ones that we're considering, the one we're considering and planning in the fall, also help us to imagine things that we haven't experienced before. And we know that exercises can unsettle people, can open eyes, and can generate new action. So we look forward to your input and to the work of this community as an input to our thinking about this exercise and to working together to try and improve pandemic preparedness. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And if people want to participate in the exercise, just reach out to you directly. Fantastic. I'd love to welcome to the stage for our closing remarks, Eduardo Martinez from the UPS Foundation. Thank you so much for hosting us.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Alan. First, I just want to recognize our distinguished panel. Please, let's recognize Peter, Julie, Richard, and Stanley Bergman. So please, help me recognize them. And Ellen has done a wonderful job moderating us, so thank you. I also want to recognize, of course, the co-host, Paul, and Alan from J&J, so thank you very much for your support. And I want to recognize Ryan Mohart from the WEF. You know, he has been a consistent voice in organizing us under this issue, so please, let's recognize Ryan. You know, it's been evident that it's amazing that we have this rising epidemic in the DRC, and again, as Stanley Bergman said, you see it nowhere. You see it nowhere. So we do have an awareness gap, we have a communication gap, and I think that I encourage the WEF to continue to organize us, to continue to shed light on this very, very important issue. But I do also want to recognize that the secret weapon really is public-private partnerships. I think without that, we cannot better prepare, we cannot better respond, and we cannot better recover from such a disaster. And I do want to recognize one individual, a global CEO, that has kept the drumbeat in this arena, and that is Mr. Stanley Bergman from Henry Schein. So please, let's recognize him, because I can tell you, as a global CEO, for him to be here with us and to be leading this charge for well over 15 years is something that we greatly, greatly appreciate. So thank you so much to all that have attended. Please carry the torch forward on this issue. Have a great rest of the conference. Thank you.